I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I am Sunil Dasgupta. One way of solving the problem of housing affordability is to build more. Trouble is, builders and developers who are supposed to be doing the building are not that interested. They complain that the regulatory regime makes new projects unfeasible. For them, the biggest culprit are rent laws that cast a long shadow of the future on the present and are making existing projects less likely to move forward. A second culprit are building standards. Right now, it's new energy rules intended to fight climate impact. But in the past, sprinklers and stairwell width have been fingered as increasing costs and hurting affordability. In Montgomery, Maryland, the county council is considering new attainable housing rules, which would open the door to zoning change near transit hubs, metro stations in particular, and allow 2, 3, and 4-unit buildings on land previously reserved for single-family homes. But according to my guests, Josh Wooldridge of the NRP Group, a top 10 developer of multifamily housing in the United States, and Brian Anlew, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Apartment and Office Building Association in suburban Maryland, easing up on rent control and cutting back on regulations are a must if the county, the state, and the country want builders to build again.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the Interstate but DMV heavy band, Finster. Kate Johnson on vocals and guitar, Doogie Whitaker on guitars, Sky Darwin on bass, and Matt Zelenz on the drums. The songs are from their 1997 album, I Wish I Had a Camera. And I want to go back. I want to go back. Want to go back. Want to go back. Josh Wooldridge, Brian Anlew, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thank you. It's my second time on the show. I'm a glutton for punishment, I guess.
Thanks, Sunil, for having me. This is quite an honor. I appreciate everything, all the value that you bring to us in the county. And so longtime listener and first time caller.
Thank you both. You have criticized the commercial property development environment in Montgomery County, Maryland, including building apartment style housing. What is your central complaint? Let's start with Josh first, since you are actually building.
When I finance a project, I go to the capital markets to borrow money for those projects, to find investors for those projects. And the thing that I've been most frustrated with is that those investors have a choice. And investing in Montgomery County has not been at the top of their list. You know, when it comes to the rent stabilization law that we have, I think we're really going to need an exemption for new construction. There's a 23-year rolling exemption. The way our projects typically work is I build the project and I'll own the project for, say, 5 years. I am most often selling our project to an institutional investor or, say, a state pension fund. They're going to own it for 10 years. They would expect, at the end of 10 years, to sell that to another institutional investor. It could be another pension fund. We're talking about what we call Class A multifamily apartments, and they're considered Class A for about 20 years. So that means that until about 20 years, they don't need major renovations. They're institutional, they're high quality. And the problem is that sort of third owner is not going to buy the property because they're going to be facing the exemption running out at 23 years. So then they're not going to buy it from the second guy. My investors aren't going to believe that we could ever exit the project and sell to one of those pension funds. So that's the challenge with the rolling exemption. I think that's been a challenge everywhere throughout the country.
What exemption do you want?
So I think we're going to need to exempt new construction, period. The district is the late 70s, as I think most folks know. It doesn't need to be that drastic. It can be relatively recent, but I think we're going to need that based on our conversations with the capital markets.
And even a January 1, 2000 exemption would still cover something like 80% of the housing in Montgomery County. Looking beyond new development, I think the challenges that we're seeing here in the county are all the different laws, policies, and regulations that make it less attractive to do business here as a multifamily or commercial building owner. You know, I think if you look at some of these things in isolation, you might think, well, that sounds like it's an okay thing, right? And I mean things like fire safety improvements or building energy performance standards that you know, reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that these buildings produce. I think we all agree we have a climate change problem, right? But now we're looking at, well, what is the cost of actually complying with the county and state's mandates, and how will that impact rents, or how will you even be able to recover those costs because of things like rent stabilization? You know, in addition to discouraging new development, you're really also discouraging making improvements to those properties and, you know, taking them from maybe a Class B or C property and making them newer and more modern.
What impact are you seeing, Brian, on existing properties?
Starting with BEPS, Building Energy Performance Standards, we're really at the starting line with that legislative mandate. The implementation timelines for that state and local mandate are 5 to 10 years, in some cases 15 years in the future. We haven't had very many buildings that have started to go through those projects, but they're really starting to do the scope of work and starting to understand what is it going to cost to do that. And so our estimates are that it's going to cost between $20,000 and $40,000 per unit to comply with BEPS. And so when you look at the way that the Montgomery County rent stabilization law is written, the most you can recover for capital improvements, assuming that all of the BEPS improvements qualified as capital improvements under the rent stabilization law, is 20% from the base rent. The conclusion we've come to is that in some instances, the cost of complying with BEPS will exceed that 20% threshold and will effectively become unrecoverable. So what do you do then?
So what do you do then?
If it's an older building stock or type, you know, maybe the owner or operator of that building sort of comes to the conclusion that the math doesn't add up, and maybe it makes sense to redevelop and to get that exemption from rate stabilization, whether it be for 23 years or indefinite, right? And so what happens then? You're sort of, you know, worst case scenario, which I don't think the county wanted as a consequence, is that there's tenant displacement resulting from that. I think the other scenario for folks that don't decide to redevelop is, well, okay, you know, we don't have a way to pay for this stuff, you know, in the short term. You know, maybe we can push off the compliance deadlines for as long as possible. Maybe there's fees or penalties for not complying.
We've been having this public discussion for 2 years now. What's somewhat scary is there's no transactions, right? So an important part of the county's revenue collection every year is transfer and recordation taxes. So this is the revenue that the county collects when individuals, but also corporations, companies, when we sell and we transfer property back and forth. And the county has come to rely on those regular transactions, but no one is transacting right now. Now, maybe they didn't transact because of the market. Maybe it was interest rates. Maybe it's because they didn't know what these regulations were going to be. Maybe it's a combination of all of them. But fiscal year 24 has just ended. I don't think we sort of have the numbers back yet. But it appeared as if we were headed for a massive fall off in transfer and recordation taxes. That's something that should be very important to really all of your listeners. When you talk about displacement, recently in the headlines, Toll Brothers, I think, purchased some apartments from, they were built in the 40s, 50s, and Chevy Chase. They're going to replace those with really, really expensive townhouses. Who's to say, Sunil, that there isn't pressure to, now that sort of Class C and Class B apartments have been devalued, what if a data center group comes in and says, you know what, that land, instead of being multifamily, is more valuable as a data center? And I know the county has their ROFR, right? The county has the right to step in and buy multifamily projects, but that's not a limitless supply of dollars to buy those projects. And for me, it's really been the devaluation of land for multifamily. On the flip side, I think land has gotten much more valuable for townhome builders.
Explain to me why land would be devalued for multifamily homes.
We've had sites that we were working on in Montgomery County, say a 4 or 5 acre parcel of land within walking distance to one of our metro stations. I would have purchased the property and I would have built, say, 400 units, 400 multifamily units, close proximity to metro. And I would have, for 400 units, I would have had to deliver 60 moderately priced dwelling units to the county as part of the approvals for the project. What I have already seen occur since the rent stabilization is the owners of those properties have said, you know what, Josh, you're a nice guy, but I don't think you're going to be able to finance a multifamily project. I'm going to go with the sure thing. I'm going to call one of the townhouse builders. They're going to build 50 townhomes. They're going to look great, right? They're going to be 4 stories, urban, rooftop decks, lots of amenities. They're going to be close to metro and they're going to be sold for well over $1 million. So instead of having 400 multifamily units rental with 60 MPDUs, you're going to see 50 townhomes that are going to be very expensive with just a handful of MPDUs. So that's an example that we're already starting to see. So I feel as though we've kind of altered our real estate DNA, right? We've made fundamental changes. And the value, that land is much more valuable to a townhouse guy. Our land around metro stations is very valuable. We don't have a lot of it left and we need as much density as possible.
I had on the show recently Rockville City Council member David Ma, who said he was a recent convert to rent stabilization, right? He had opposed it in 2023, but now he supports it. He told me that the idea is to have rent stabilization across the market. And so that means that he thinks it is possible to build a market where there isn't that much of regulatory arbitrage. And we see politically rent stabilization becoming more acceptable at the national level now. If you listen to the campaigns, if that is the plan, what is your response?
I think that federal proposal by the Biden campaign and now the Harris campaign on nationwide temporary 2-year cap on rents is going to go nowhere in Congress.
I think once the federal government says that they want this, then that percolates and locals organize around that call to action at the local level. Rockville has cloistered discussion right now, right? But next year they may say, no, let's do it if the federal government says, oh, this is good.
maybe in Rockville, but AOBA represents multifamily property owners in DC and Northern Virginia. And I can tell you, I talk to my Northern Virginia counterparts every week, and this is not, rent control is not going anywhere in Northern Virginia.
I'm not in the business, so I don't know exactly how this plays out. But I know politics. I know there's a political climate that is ready for more rent stabilization, it seems. The people that are advocating for this are thinking that they can effectively reduce the regulatory arbitrage that you keep talking about with Northern Virginia. They believe they can do that. Given those political conditions, what do you have to respond?
I can't handicap at the national level, but I will say, I think if for the foreseeable future, investors are going to have options when they choose to invest. And I think that they will continue to, they'll vote with their feet, right? And we already know that we just have this massive deficit of housing in the DC Metro, in the state of Maryland, in Montgomery County. And I think we can all agree, right? The last 2 years has been fascinating and it's been a big learning experience for me. But generally what's happened here the last 2 years, rent stabilization, it's not helping us get more housing built.
And I would add that it feels like this conversation about rent stabilization and rent control is like any other fad, and that it's cyclical, right? And that, you know, the lessons learned from previous generations of rent control weren't, you know, a lot of those folks aren't around anymore to, you know, remind folks that this led to bad outcomes. And so now it's come back in sort of this second generation of rent stabilization policies.
Well, you may be absolutely right, but they are, just as there are business cycles, there are political cycles. And this entire reaction, right, is a consequence, you would think, of the pandemic and the rising costs.
The Rockville City Rent Control staff report had an interesting chart that if you go back and look at it, it looked at rent increases over the last essentially like 20 years and compared it to inflation. And what it found is that on average, rent increases are relatively flat over that time period. And what hasn't kept up has been wages. And we have a workforce development problem.
There is absolutely no doubt. But that still doesn't solve the problem of the person that has to live there. When people are stuck, when things don't get resolved, right, they act politically. And in this case, they're acting politically by asking their representatives to bring in rent stabilization, which, according to many, many people and quite a lot of research, is economically unviable.
One of the things that the last 2 years has highlighted for me is mobility of our residents. And the easiest way, if you're a renter and you receive a crazy rent increase, first of all, you should always negotiate with your landlord. But the easiest way is to move out, move to another unit. And I think that there is this...
Moving out is costly, though. I mean, if you have kids costly, and things...
It's costly, and it goes back to our decades of issues with land use, right? We have created these pockets in Montgomery County. We have challenges in Montgomery County. We've got a spectacular agricultural reserve. We have all of these constraints on us. And what's highlighted for me the last 2 years is that the easiest way to stick it to your landlord is to move out to the next guy, move to the next building. The problem is, for that senior citizen that relies on that public transportation at the bottom of their building, and their social networks and their churches nearby, or family with their schools, the problem is there are no other options. And that's what's really coming home to roost for us right now. Because, I'm not going to be the developer that sits here and says, it's just a supply issue. We just need to build our way out of it. That's part of it. But it really comes back to our land use and the sort of structural challenges that we have.
Fundamentally, we are constrained by the, you know, single family zoning. And changing that is a bear that nobody wants to take on.
Well, I wouldn't say a nobody. I think the planning board and planning department through their attainable housing.
I wish you were elected, Brian.
You know, no comment. I'll leave that one there. But, you know, the council is getting ready to take up those attainable housing strategies. And I think we could see some movement.
Then we will exactly address the issues that Josh is talking about.
But not fully. We have made it more attractive to build, you know, townhomes, and, you know, to the extent that single family zoning is opened up, we'll have made it more attractive to build duplexes, triplexes, and quads in vast parts of the county. But it will still not be as attractive to build more dense multifamily housing.
The other real big issue has been that housing itself, right, the construction of it, the operation of it has become more and more expensive.
The challenges that we've had recently with costs has been unlike anything I've ever seen. And, you know, I always say, Sunil, no one needs to feel sorry for us, right? Nobody needs to feel sorry for me. But, you know, our counterparts in Florida aren't able to insure their projects anymore. Or if they are going to insure them, the costs are out of control. The only thing I can share is that construction costs are coming down. Certainly, we know the Fed is going to begin cutting rates. So we're getting some relief on the horizon. But the cost in operating these projects has gone way beyond the amount of the limit on the income and the rents for the project.
So how do the numbers work out?
In order to cover your debt service, you have to take more money out of your pocket and contribute it to the project because the project may not cash flow anymore. That's a real thing. That's a real thing that I don't hear our elected officials really appreciate. And so what happens if you can't cover the debt service? You start to see projects headed to auction. You start to see them headed to special servicers. To do our projects, I go to the capital markets. I am the biggest cheerleader of Montgomery County out there, right? I'm going all over the world and I'm talking about all the benefits of investing in a project in Montgomery County. So that's, you know, developers that have money, Sunil, are retired, right? They're not living here anymore. So as developers, it's our job to go all over the world seeking that investment, bringing it back to the county here and building. One of the things I haven't mentioned is that my company builds more affordable housing than anybody else in the country. We build workforce housing. We build market rate. It's very unique. We get up every day to build housing.
So tell me, where do you build most of that? It's certainly not in Montgomery County or Maryland, right?
Yeah, correct. So we've closed on our first affordable project in the district. And we are working on affordable projects in Montgomery County. It's just very early. So we build them all over the country, though.
You are building in the county.
We've got a project under construction in the White Oak area, you know, East County, 388 units, getting ready to open. It'll be opening here in the next 3 to 6 months. We have a project at the moment in Bethesda that's going through the approval process. And then we have other projects at the very, very early stages for affordable. Wherever we build market rate, Sunil, we want to be building affordable as well, because that's my company. That's my company's DNA, is to be building for all income levels. So we've also got some affordable projects here in Montgomery County, just at the very early stages.
So how many projects in total?
So right now I'm kind of actively working on three, right? One that's under construction, one that's going through the approval process, and then early on. Now, I'm always evaluating things that come across our desk. New opportunities come across our desk all the time.
Those three, at least, they appear to be viable under these conditions. They would be better if you got the exemption to become indefinite. But right now, as they stand, they are, you know, workable, not quite good, but workable.
With our White Oak project that's under construction, I don't have a choice, right? I can't stop construction. I can't. It's under roof. It's coming. It's going to open.
Yeah, but that's also financed, right?
It's also financed.
And you lined up the finance for that one before rent stabilization.
Yeah, early 21. Our Bethesda project, we'll see. It's just, we'll see what happens. And then Anything that we do affordable, Sunil, we utilize the low-income housing tax credit program, the LIHTC program for affordable projects.
So Josh drew a fairly bright line in the sand on the exemption for new construction and having, you know, a fixed date exemption rather rolling. You know, I think some other things that the county could do to make things better, as I keep bringing this conversation back to, you know, all of these costs that are being imposed on owners and operators, is make it as easy as possible to recover those costs. And the county simply has not done that. As part of the rent stabilization law and regulations, you have to jump through all kinds of hoops and provide all kinds of documentation to do basically anything, right? So the state and county are saying you have to make energy efficiency improvements and figure out how to pay for it. And once you do that, now you have to get approval to raise rents to pay for it. And it's going to be this long, cumbersome process that requires all of these bureaucrats in county government to figure out, you know, whether these things should be approved or not. That is not making it easy to do business here. I mean, so much so that the county had to hire 9 new FTEs, full-time equivalents, to help implement the rent stabilization law, right? And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, when the county executive first took office, his mandate was to reduce the size of county government, and he's done the opposite.
To me, it seems fairly simple to advocate for a seamless process between BEPS and capital improvements that allow rents to be raised under rent stabilization. That feedback loop can be constructed.
It should. I think it hasn't. And when the council was considering the rent stabilization law, you know, there was no consideration given to BEPS at the time. And so the way that they defined capital improvements, for example, is not even helpful, because some of the things that will need to be done to comply with BEPS do not fall under the county's narrow definition of what is a capital improvement.
What's an example?
What's written in the law, and that what the county has taken to their credit, to DHCA's credit, has taken a bit of an expansive view, is that capital improvements are permanent structural alterations, right? But there's no definition anywhere in county code of what the word structural means. Is HVAC a structural improvement? Are you actually, you know, moving structures to HVAC? The county's Department of Housing has taken the expansive view that, sure, that may be a structural improvement, even if it's not strictly moving structures, right? But you might have to do electrification of domestic hot water systems.
Well, if the county has been expansive, they are responding to you.
I'm getting to that. You have to do domestic hot water system electrification to comply with BEPS. Is that a structural improvement? Is that included anywhere in the definition of capital improvement? Probably not. That's something that will need to be cleaned up. Piping insulation, that's not a structural improvement that's being made, but that's something that you need to do to comply with BEPS.
Have you presented a list?
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of the problem, again, right? Because we're looking at these policies, you know, sort of in isolation, right? You have one side of the county Department of Environmental Protection, that's looking at the BEPS regulations and saying, we have a mandate to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and energy consumption. And then we have another part of the county that's saying, we have a mandate to reduce the increases of rents. Right. And they're not necessarily talking to each other, even though the Department of Environmental Protection knows and has some examples of some of the work that will need to be done to comply with BEPS. So we're actively having those conversations. But it brings me back to my overall point that I think a lot of times the county takes a look at these policies in very, very narrow ways and doesn't think about the bigger picture of what's happening here.
The coordination problem in government is a longstanding one, obviously, right? And, you know, but I mean, if you have a list, and on top of the list was your issue with you know, HVAC, and you said the county is willing to take a more expansive view, that means that they are being reasonable. A lot of laws are written like that. You know, you give them a list and say, hey, look, if you want this to work, you know, these things have to be taken into account. And then they say, no, we don't care. Don't come to me. That's cause for heartbreak.
Yeah, absolutely. No, look, we have our list. We're in ongoing conversations with the executive branch on a lot of these things, and we're hopeful that we can work some of this out. I'm not sure that it will. You know, it would require some legislative changes. Maybe there'll be some appetite at the council to take some of that up, including the fixed date exemption. But we'll see. We'll see. We're also at the beginning stages of implementation. So, you know, we just finished having a hard fought battle over, you know, what the regulations should be, and all of that. And so now, you know, particularly going into an election year, there may not be as much appetite to make wholesale changes to the policies.
Yeah, I really don't also know whether a fixed date exemption is politically feasible. I think council members would find it very difficult to push that, and you know,
maybe not with this council. That you know, that may very well be. Maybe not with this council. We're about 2 years away from the next election, and the next election cycle kicks off next year. So we'll see who the candidates are then. And between now and then, there's a lot of interesting things happening in county politics.
Brian Andlew, I love your optimism about politics. Josh Woolrich, thank you for taking the time. Please come back.
Yeah, absolutely. I hate politics, right?
I wish I meant it. That was Brian Anlow of the Apartment and Office Building Association, which represents owners of buildings in Montgomery County and Prince George's County. And Josh Woolrich of the NRP Group, one of the biggest builders of apartments in the country. Since this episode is so focused on rent laws, I should point out that while economic modeling finds price caps of any kind to be counterproductive, rent stabilization, which is rent control 2.0, a more nuanced approach, can work sometimes. The Urban Institute recently published a paper which contends that while rent stabilization does in fact lead to a decrease in overall housing supply, there is an unexpected increase in housing supply at the lowest income segment, at about 30% of area median income. Why this should happen? I have asked the authors. Stay tuned.
Run, fast, trying to keep my beat, but they're stomping all around from the unified bounds. Running with the times, gotta keep in the laws. Heaven on the noise, if I go off the road, I've got a mean streak, I can tell. I got one foot in heaven and the other in hell. You can sit and chime those bells, but as for me, I'm out of here.
That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from the interstate but DMV-heavy band Finster. Kate Johnson on vocals and guitar, Doogie Whitaker on guitars, Sky Darwin on bass, and Matt Zelenz on the drums. The songs come from their 1997 album, I Wish I Had a Camera. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihbpod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time. Sit and